jazz.
Busted.
Okay.
Okay, we all set?
Let's do this.
All okay. Right. Welcome to Jazz Bad. Let me try this again. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 150. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
And we have a special guest tonight. Could you introduce yourself, special guest?
I am Sarah Bernstein.
Yay.
Yay.
I figured I'd probably get that right, but I'm not sure about your collaborator, so we're going to ask you to name him in a minute. But your album, or your name rather, on your album, which is Crazy Light Shining, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Do you go by Sarah Bernstein Unearthish sometimes, or is that like a name of a group or a...
That's the name of the group. That's the name of the group. And it's a duo. I have been known to perform under Sarah Bernstein Unearthish solo as well, but it's generally a duo with Satoshi Takeishi on percussion.
This recording we're talking about is your second recorded collaboration with him?
Exactly. The first one came out in 2011, and that one was just named Unearthish. So that one's listed a little differently. It's listed Sarah Bernstein and then Unearthish, but it's really the same group, same project. I think this is the second album. It's us after a few more years, new material.
Okay.
That's cool because, you know, we get review copies and trying to kind of put them into context, sometimes the metadata is amazingly important to know what's going on.
Right.
I got a great double album from a saxophone player and it was a 2-album set, but there was no indication which number one song was from what disc. So it was like,
wow,
okay, what order does this go in? Because it was kind of an ambitious suite. So it's really important that I know which one comes first. And anyway, so we find that out, that it's amazingly important to kind of orient yourself in these spaces.
It's difficult too with digital, with things showing up on, you know, digitally. It would be ideal to have everything just under Sarah Bernstein as the artist, I'm finding. But that doesn't really reflect what I do, which is to have many different groups. So as a result, in the digital space now, I have many different artist names. So that's just how that goes.
It seems to be a common thing. I mean, we found this, it's Brooklyn is like ground zero for this sort of thing. We found this with all kinds of people who collaborate on other people's albums. I think Chris Davis was on one of your albums. And
yes,
someone who's appeared on a bunch of Mary Halverson albums, who appeared on Tamika Reeves' album. And like, everybody knows everyone and everyone plays with everyone. And it gets it's complicated. Yeah, maybe everyone should. I would like it if everyone used their name, but I get why. I get the, you know, different groups have different identities and so forth. So I guess it makes sense. But yeah, it would be cool if everything was Sarah Bernstein, then we would know.
I think I'm going to try for that somehow in the future. Maybe I'll go in that direction. So stay tuned.
Yeah.
But so far, this is how it's been.
And I have to ask before we get into your music real quick, are you any relation to the other person? We're going to talk about it.
Oh, you mean Elmer?
No, not Elmer. But although we have talked about Elmer on a podcast, I think he's responsible for the Magnificent Seven theme song, right?
Dun, I think so.
I believe that's him. We're doing an album by Andrew Bernstein.
Oh, okay.
Do you know this person or no?
No.
Because all Bernsteins must be related. That's my theory.
Right there, and there are quite a few good ones in jazz. But no, I actually don't know.
Okay.
Andrew. And I'm not related to many of the ones. There's Peter also, right?
Yes, yes.
But not, right, also not related. Haven't met him, I don't think.
All right, sorry. That was just stupid. That was because it's just interesting that we have to do all this. But
no, I know. It's a common name that sounds maybe like it's not going to be as common as it really is.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, so anyway, tonight we're going to talk with Sarah a little bit about her career in music and her new release, Crazy Light Shining, and then we're going to talk about 3 other releases, at least two of which I think we could fairly characterize as experimental. And Mike will introduce those after our interview with Sarah. So that's how this podcast is going to go, we think. We'll see what really happens. We never
fingers crossed.
Yeah, that's right. So I thought I'd just begin, and I apologize. Apparently, I can no longer handle two glasses of red wine of an evening. I'm going to have to cut back to one. Just a little bit for our listeners, you know, background of your kind of life story in a nutshell and your career as a musician so far.
Okay. Well, I'm from San Francisco, California, and I grew up listening to a lot of music, a lot of influenced also by a lot of poetry and writers and different experiences. My first instrument was actually piano, did a lot of singing, I did a lot of different things at the same time. While being involved in classical violin training, I was also writing and doing performative things. So I continued from there and went to music schools or programs at universities that were music related, including San Francisco State and also CalArts. And then later after I moved to New York in the 90s, I went to Queens College and I did a master's in jazz there. And all the time being involved at the time, I was freelancing a lot as a violinist. All the time also working on my own music and putting together groups. And eventually I was able to segue out of being somewhat of a random violinist and more into a full-time artist, doing mostly my own music, but of course being very also involved in other people's projects here in New York.
And I am picturing you on a segue with a violin.
Okay, there you go.
Going across the city. Well, that's cool. Yeah. This is... I guess Mike and I are of the generation, we kind of grew up as college kids listening to Laurie Anderson's music. And that was, you know, not that this is the same thing, but you do some spoken word, you do some singing, you play violin, you've got a percussionist. But you're involved with a lot of different projects, right? So this one is basically a duo with, I assume, some studio work, but I think a lot of it, I mean, it's a beautifully recorded album. I feel like I can really hear the tone of the violin, hear the percussion very well. But it's basically a duet. What are some of the other contexts you find yourself in right now at this point in your career before we get deeply into Crazy Light Shining?
Another one of my projects is represented on this Sarah Bernstein Quartet album, which is it's a more traditional jazz setting of bass, drums, piano, but with violin and also with electric bass, which some people find to be a different sound. That album is more instrumental and possibly more of a straightforward experience for some people. Still, I do consider it still to be experimental music, but it's out on a Leo Records. It's a sort of a jazz label in England.
Yeah.
And that project's ongoing, and I'm gearing up to record another album. And I also have music I've written for string quartet that I've performed over the years, and it hasn't been recorded yet, but that's an important project to me that I'd like to get recorded. And then I have an active collaboration with another drummer, Kid Millions, and we have two albums out and we're getting ready to record our third. And that is, it's fully improvised, very, very much electronic sounds in terms of violin, very processed and processed voice. And it's a somewhat ecstatic music, I think. It has a louder feel.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
Cool.
So that's some of them. And there are a few others, but that gives you an idea.
So how did the collaboration with Satoshi Takeishi come about? Because obviously this is an ongoing effort. I mean, you guys have recorded now two albums and so there's a kind of, history and a dialogue there. How did that come about, and you know, how did you find someone who was simpatico with the kinds of things you want to do on this album? How did that all come into being?
That was interesting. Going back to the first Unearthish album, I had been playing and working on most of the pieces on that album as a solo performance for some years, and had even tried to record it, and it didn't click for me. At a certain point, I started to experiment with adding other people to the band, and I tried, well, maybe it needs to have guitar actually, or maybe it needs bass. So I even tried it once with violin and piano. So I tried a few different things, and that wasn't it. And then I met Satoshi on another project that we were both on a performance project. And we just started talking about playing. And I think we played a session at my house, not related to this project, just with some other musicians. So we started to play a little bit. And then I just had the feeling that it would really work based on he was interested in the words. You know, he was interested in my words. I think he just found it interesting, and his interest made me see that we should give it a try. And it turns out to be exactly what the project needed.
Well, it's cool because, you know, the collaboration between the two of you is really kind of electric. It sounds like there's some over recordings in some places, but even where it's just the two of you, where it sounds like it's just him on percussion and you on violin, and then the stuff isn't as processed as it is on some numbers. It feels very intuitive and very kind of compatible, as if you're sort of listening and playing, responding to each other in real time. And that mm-hmm. kind of leads me to wonder how much of what's on the album is written out and sort of performed exactly, you know, mm-hmm. to specification, and how much of it is through organic collaboration, you know, kind of emerged, and it looks or so it sounds a certain way mm-hmm. because of that collaboration.
Well, you're right, first of all, that not much is overlaid. You're right, in recording, there are the first song, yes, you know, Four Plants, that one has a lot of overdub.
Four Plants, Four Plants, Four Plants, Four Plants, Four Plants. Where the abstract become matter, and feel. Turning unreal to real, and real to unreal, earth to unearth, unearth to earth.
But most of what we do is live, and I think he in the studio overdubbed a few things here and there. But the live performance is a lot like what you hear on the recording when we play. And his parts are his own. I don't tell him, you know, what to play. I think there are a few places where I've had suggestions, but mostly it's just based on the rhythmic concepts that are written. You know, he's going to come up with something that sounds great. And in terms of my part, what is written and what is played, I'd have to show you the score, I think. You know, it's piece to piece. There are some pieces where almost every note is written. And then there are other ones where it's largely improvised, but nothing is completely improvised on that album. No, it's every piece has quite a bit of writing. Yeah.
Yeah, there's I think it is experimental music. It's going to be challenging for some listeners, but there are structures to these songs. There are patterns. It's not, you know, Albert Eiler freak out style.
No, it's not. Although that's wonderful, but no, not on this album.
No, it's a godsend in the particular context of the particular situation Mike put me into this week. But we'll talk about that. There's a reckoning coming, but you don't have to be here for that. It's going to be awful. So one thing I noticed was at times, and this is revealing as so many things I say does reveal my ignorance, some of the tonality sounded to me coming from a slightly Asian place. That's, you know, you can see I just don't have the vocabulary to kind of be intelligent about this, but just some of the sounds, some of the harmonies at times to my ignorant ears reminded me a little bit of, you know, and obviously this is, you know, what, a third of the world's population, Asian music, or, you know, Japanese or Chinese music, and especially on what I think of as the single from the album, which is Safe. The song that seems the most kind of, I like it. I really like it a lot, in fact, but it's the most song-like and digestible, the most patterned. So I don't know whether I'm completely off base there or just where you get your harmonic ideas from, or if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I probably wouldn't describe it that way, but I think of all the musics, you know, of all the sounds, I do love folkloric music from every part of the world. Love, and also I've been involved with in some way, or, you know, I've played some, but so that's might be what's coming through there. I think of that rhythm to me is possibly a little more African influenced, but it might be the way it's put together, and also the fact that I'm doing pizzicato, and it has on the violin, pizzicato might be reminiscent of that type of sound. And there's something basically pentatonic going on.
Okay.
So, yeah. You know, so, but, so I guess I think of it more of it's from somewhere in the world. It's, you know, it's relating to something, but for me, that's all musics from like indigenous peoples is very, it is an influence. Yes. I don't necessarily think it's an influence in all my music, but I think in that song and maybe in some things I write, it could come through.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to agree with Pat. I like the project altogether, but I really liked Safe.
And, oh, good.
And the reason, part of the reason I liked it so much is, gosh, you're a good singer.
Thank you.
And so that leads me to wonder, on some of the cuts, I think it's, well, it's interesting. On some of the cuts, there's like spoken word poetry, but it's not always, the way you do the spoken word isn't always the same. So that on some songs, it sounds more monotonic, but then like on Drastic Times, that's not monotonic. That is to say, you're not singing, but there is inflection and nuance. Whereas on other, or on some of the other songs, Crazy Light Shining, it's almost monotonic. So I was wondering, how do you make the choice on cut to cut, whether to sing, or whether to sort of recite in a more, you know, flat tone, or whether to recite with a certain kind of nuance or expressivity that might not be in every song?
That's a hard question. Do you still hear me?
I do.
Okay, yeah. That's a hard one. Probably because I don't decide. I think this project, you know, that for the it could be either a strength or a weakness. It's definitely a fact. There's different kinds of material that we're putting together into one. So some people might find that almost like a schizophrenic or something. I think it's working. And especially because I've already been doing it for a while. Like the first album is really the same. We have some spoken, we have some singing, we have some instrumental. So it was a natural thing for me to continue that, which is, that's not what you asked, but that's related, I think. So I think the way I decide is I'm really making small pieces, and they have their own logic to me. They have their own theater. So one of them, I think each one is its own story. Each one is its own. And so I'm following what they need to exist.
Okay. that's all right. Can I follow up on that a little bit? So then a couple of things strike me as really interesting then. So for example, I think that the spoken stuff, especially in Drastic Times, is really effective.
Oh.
And in part it has to do with the way in which, I mean, it sounds like there's a kind of a key phrase there, which has then been broken into parts. And the key phrase is what? Tragic times call for drastic measures.
Drastic times require tragic measures.
Drastic times require tragic measures.
It's much darker that way. Yes.
It appears in fragments. And I believe we only get that phrase whole one time. And we get you know, pieces. And I thought that was incredibly effective. And I also liked that in that particular cut, the spoken part was more expressive, almost questioning, like, is this the right way? Or how does this maybe go here? And it just had me on the edge of my seat. I was really listening. It was very effective as a kind of earworm to kind of, you know, get me to sit up and go, what is happening here? And I thought that I liked that a lot. And by the same token, I just thought the singing on Safe was really powerful. And I don't know. I mean, have you ever thought of doing more with singing? I mean,
yes, I do. I have a new.
It's good. It's good.
I have a new project. It's called Day So Far, and it's kind of a synth pop band. And I'm singing every tune. And there is actually one tune where I do spoken word, but I think it's the more dramatic kind that you're talking about, like. But that it's in the context of a synth pop project. So that's a new thing. It's with Stuart Popejoy on bass, who, you know, I do a lot of stuff with. He's my husband. And Danny Tunick on drums.
Cool.
So yeah, stay tuned for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I thought in terms of the vocal parts, those were the two most effective numbers. Okay. The others were good, but those two really stood out for me. Just vocally. But I also like, you did a little bit of the rearranging of words in a kind of inviting way on the first cut for Plants, because there's a line in there where it says, come in to feel free. You know, and it's obviously feel free to come in, but come in to feel free is clever.
Okay,
you know, it kind of invites you. And it's a nice gesture as the first song on the album. It's as if you're saying to the listener, come in to feel free. If that's what you want to do, come in.
Right.
With me and Satoshi as we do some, you know, trippy stuff.
Thanks for this careful listening. I appreciate it.
Well, it's an album that kind of demands. I mean, yeah. I guess we should like, you know, say this. You know, it's an album that demands careful listening. We talk about this with some other artists. I think the person we've talked about this maybe the most about is Henry Threadgill. On some of his projects, he does some very kind of abstract stuff, but he uses space and silence really effectively, and he does it in a way that kind of forces you to kind of hang on to every sound that you're hearing to kind of attend to what's happening. And I feel that on several of the tracks here, you achieve a similar kind of intensity of, you foist on the reader, the listener, a similar intensity of focus because of the work that Satoshi is doing, along with what you're doing on violin, kind of forces the listener to kind of, you know, hang tight and listen carefully. This was not, I mean, I've talked about this before in the podcast, but Pat and I listen to these in different kinds of ways, and I listen to everything one time through, and then I just put it into a podcast playlist, and then I listen to that from time to time, and, you know, stuff just comes up randomly. And whenever your stuff came up, it was like, it didn't become background. It was like, okay, it's going to force itself on my, it's going to force me to listen and think and to attend carefully. Whereas some things you hear and it's kind of like, okay, that's, I can work to that, you know.
Right.
But Crazy Light Shining kind of really forces you to pay attention. It's demanding in a good way, I think.
Yeah. Hmm. Maybe that's Satoshi's effect. He's wonderful. And I think you're right, though, that the two of us, we are listening very carefully ourselves. Of course, I know all musicians do, but I think we have that special thing with space and time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would it be unfair to ask you to interpret the lyrics of one of your songs for us?
It depends which one. Which one did you have in mind?
I want a roadmap to map or meaningless map.
Oh, okay.
Map or meaningless map? Prolonged sunset. Ice clouds. Thank you. A calm enthusiasm should suffice. The fuzziness of an empty slate.
Or just can you say kind of, you don't have to like explain it, just like where does it come from? Like where did the idea for that song?
It's okay for the right brain to drive things.
The problem is, so I'm going to try some. The problem is that I don't always remember. Like I could tell you more about Drastic Times in a weird way, but this one I've got it here in front of me just in case I got a hard question. I can tell you about a little bit about how I wrote it. I'm not sure about why I wrote it right now, but I do remember that this is one that was, I wrote more and then I subtracted things. So I subtracted things quite a bit. So it's, you know, it's a short poem essentially, but it was longer and it was probably more personal even, you know, I love personal things, but in a way, I do want things to be more. I sometimes want to make things more generic. I want to make them more universal. I don't want it. So I will cross things out that are directly about me, and I'll try to put it in some words that might be more evocative and less specific. So I think I crossed out a lot of stuff, and as a result, it ends up sounding very very disjointed. But then I try to make sense out of that, make order out of that, because I like things that are disjointed, but of course it also has to have a certain order. So that's one thing about the writing of it and what it really means. Let me think here.
That's a spoiler. Well, no spoilers.
That's a spoiler.
It's going to take me too much time.
I was going to say one other thing here about Drastic Times. We've gotten a few review copies recently. Apparently, the political situation in the United States has some people exercised. Who knew? Some of the albums we listen to have, and it's interesting, some of the jazz review copies we've been getting are taking an overt turn toward the political, with varying degrees of, I would say, limited success based on the stuff we've heard so far. But I thought Drastic Times is really effective. And I don't know if it was meant directly to reflect political issues or whatever, but I just thought, this would be a really cool anthem to play at a political rally. I don't know. It just it kind of summed up, or it felt like it was somehow pertinent to the times we find ourselves in. And because it wasn't, you know, it's not naming names, it's not talking about orange-haired baboons behind desks.
Right.
For that reason, it actually has a kind of, and you were addressing this a moment ago when you're talking about map or meaningless map, because it's not so specific, it actually has a more universal, abstract quality. And for that reason, I thought it was all the more effective. I don't know if that was the intent, but that's what I heard when I listened to it. I thought, oh, wow, this is an awfully clever set of digs here. I thought it was quite good in that context. I mean, that may not have been how you intended it. That's kind of how I heard it.
Well, the interesting thing is I wrote this a while ago. I think it was, I'm not even sure when, but it was definitely before the current situation. You know, it was sometime during the, you know, Obama years. But, and I actually had a feeling like, I was like, wow, is this out of date? And, you know, because, you know, then, because so many things have changed. And on my first album, there's one of the pieces I really like on it is called War. And that's another interesting one to check out. Anyway, but this Drastic Times, so I was actually wondering if it would feel dated, and then I just realized that it just gets reinterpreted a little bit, and it actually, in some ways, it felt more, you know, more relevant or different. I was really happy that people even saw it as political and saw some of my work as political, because I don't sit down to write about political things, definitely not, but I'm definitely a radical news junkie. You could say, like a hardcore sofa activist.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite kind? Is it fake or real news? What's the kind you like the best?
Oh, I like the fake real news. You know, I don't know, but you know. So I don't really write. I don't sit down to write that stuff. But sometimes things do inspire me from just listening to a lot of stuff and listening to a lot of news and odd stuff. I mean, it does get in there.
it's interesting because when if someone, you know, sits down and says, today I'm going to write an angry jazz song about the current administration,
right.
that's usually not going to go real well.
Right. Some people do it.
Weird.
Some people manage it. I mean, I think of something. The things I like are like take it back to like Mingus's song titles.
Yeah. You
know, that kind of stuff. Wow. I mean, you know, so some people really have a way. I think you can do it in different ways, like just that, just song titles, or just like call the album something and don't do anything with the music. Mm. That kind of thing. It interests me.
Pat and I have been having an ongoing low grade, he doesn't know he's in a war with us, but we're having a low grade war with Wadada Leo Smith,
who's
a wonderful, wonderful player, but he's been making albums. And we think he's doing just that. He's giving them provocative titles.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
He's just doing what he does, right? So his most recent 2-disc album, which we're going to talk about at some point, is called America's National Parks. And, you know, so there's songs in there called Yellowstone or Grand Tetons. But when you listen to it, you don't think, gosh, this is the Yellow. It's just him doing what he always does. You know?
Yeah, that's.
So, yeah, we're going to
That's a point against what I just said, but
I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, I know. You're probably right though. It's, you know, I think just, it's got to come from, it's just got to come from in your, in the impulse has to, hopefully the impulse lines up, but yeah, I don't know what drives everybody. It's hard that you're in a difficult position of having to analyze that.
Or just talk about it intelligently, which we really manage. But anyway.
We should try that, talking about it intelligently. We haven't so far, but...
You know, every podcast we say, this time we're going to try. And then
episode 151 is when it's going to happen.
That's right.
So we've got a pool going. I just want to know, when you're relaxing at home and you put on some music, what do you listen to?
Oh, so lately I got back into... listening to this amazing violinist, Pupi Legarreta, Cuban, and listening to his early recordings, which I hadn't heard very much, but, you know, now we find a different collection of stuff online than, you might find previously. So I've been listening to that. It's like charanga music, which I am influenced by because I played a lot of it maybe 10 years ago. So that's one thing. And then I listen to the radio a lot.
You're the one.
I'm the one who listens. So there, I listen to, you know, New York, we have good radio. So we have WKCR and I listen to that. And, you know, we have WBAI has some interesting programs, though there's also a lot of talk on there. So, and I don't know what else. Sometimes, not to relax, I put on albums that people have given me, friends and colleagues, and I listen to those more with attention. And sometimes I even write to those now because I'm not sure exactly how to listen to them. So I'll journal while listening to those. That's been interesting. Mm. And then, like I said, I listen to a lot of podcasts, like I'll have to start listening to yours more. I listen to a lot of political podcasts. So I listen to like Intercepted and Deconstructed and Democracy Now and things like that. It's not music.
Least relevant name ever for a podcast at the moment, but hopefully it'll come back into vogue.
Yeah.
Democracy soon, maybe.
Right.
That would be fun. Well, I'm losing the pool. I assumed it was just yacht rock with a heavy dose of Seals and Croft. So I was wrong.
No, but I'll go through and we've been doing some good 80s pop listening too, so I'll get into that.
Well, you did mention the synth group. Yeah, I was thinking, is this little Depeche Mode going on?
Depeche Mode, yeah.
Now you're speaking our language.
Okay, yeah.
Children of the
80s, what are your favorite bands from that era?
What do you say, Mike?
Oh, dear. Oh, from what era? When we were young and thoughtful, young and idealistic? I don't know. I'm an REM completist. I can't help it. I know that just marks me out as the ultimate dad rock lover, but I love REM. I love Wilco. I adore everything Lloyd Cole ever put on recording. I think he's fantastic. But like Pat, you know, I listen to tons of stuff. I mean, I listen to all sorts of whack shit. Recently, I've been really into this double disc set of, you probably know it, from Cuban dancers. There's a label called Fania Records.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the stuff I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's the shit.
So good.
Yeah, it's a compilation. It's two discs of All Stars. They just do, and it's a whole bunch of different cuts, you know. So
right.
I love that stuff. You know, so all kinds of goofy stuff in addition to, you know, the jazz that we listen to and whatever else. It's all Steely Dan over at Pat's house, though.
Right. And then there's always Late Miles and that kind of thing. It's always worth listening to again and again.
That's true.
And then, I don't know. That's about all I have to say about that right now. But I'll think of plenty of things once we're no longer talking.
Is there we'll splice it in. Is there a website that, you know, indicates where you're going to be and what groups you're playing with so that we can tell listeners where to go and hear you live?
Yes. SarahBernstein.com. I have a calendar up there, and I'm playing coming up if anybody's in New York. I've got a bunch of stuff, some things that stand out. I'll be at the Stone with thereminist named Pamela Stickney.
Awesome.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I actually know a guy who plays theremin.
Okay.
Yeah, I've actually, he let me practice. I mean,
it's
all practice. He let me make noise. Yeah, how cool is that?
Wow. So I'll be there on September 29th. The group Unearthish with Satoshi has a very nice performance in December 11th, at a nice gallery in Brooklyn called the Arete Gallery. And then there's many things in between those two. I know there's something at Downtown Music Gallery, which is always a fun place to play, coming up. There's all these nice, interesting underground clubs and above ground clubs in New York, and you can see me at many of them. So it was SarahBernstein.com, and my recordings are up there too. So if people want to check out some of the other recordings, you can link to them.
Right on.
Yep.
Oh, this is good because I'd only seen Unearthish and Live Free, I guess, Live Free?
Still Free.
Still Free, excuse me, Still Free. And this obviously lists projects where it lists the Kid Millions projects.
Right.
And some other things as well. Wow, this is nice. Cool.
Yeah, there's an interesting album that we put out last year, I think early last year, called Propolis. And that's only digital. You can link to it from my website. It's on Bandcamp. And a Bay Area label called Minus Zero put it out. And that's also an interesting album. It's through improvised with Alex Marcello on piano and keyboards, Stuart Popejoy on bass and electronics, and Nick Podgorski on drums. And it's like a noise jazz album or something like that. So that's another one that might blow your ears in an interesting direction.
That sounds good. That sounds really good. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Pat.
No, I didn't have any anything to interject, really. Just it sounds like that is a place I was wondering where we could get, if you're somebody who still purchases physical media or could download your records. And it sounds like your recordings. It sounds like if they go to your website, that will lead them where they would need to go.
That's right. That's right.
Awesome. Okay. Ba-da-da. Ga-da-da. Any final words, sir?
Who, me?
For Sarah,
I've talked too much. Sorry.
Well, thank you for your patience. It took us a while to get this to come together, and then my stupid Skype didn't want to work. But we really appreciate you coming on the show. It was neat to hear about the project. I really enjoyed it. It was an oasis in a pretty rough couple of weeks of music listening. So,
wow, good.
You don't want to listen to the rest of the podcast when this goes live, Sarah, to hear Pat kvetch.
Yes, indeed, as only a German can. So thanks again for coming on, and we look forward to hearing from you again, okay?
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on and checking out the music. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
Great talking to you.
All right.
Okay.
The song is ended, but the melody lingers on. You and the song have gone. But the melody lingers on.
That was fun.
It was, yeah.
Right on.
It went great. And, you know, we talk about earworms a lot, but never overlook ear drills. You know, the music that just goes in your brain and kind of stirs up the gray matter. So why don't you tell our listeners about the remaining selections for tonight's podcast, which focuses all these releases for 2018.
That is true. These are things that came across the transom.
And we're not letting Mike pick again for a while. But yeah, he kind of...
What the hell? You big crybaby? What's wrong with you?
He stuck his hand in and just kind of...
I just reached in. A part of it was just synchrony. Since we were having Sarah Bernstein on, I thought, let's talk about Andrew Bernstein's album called An Exploded View, which is Andrew playing reed by himself with some overdubbing. It must be some overdubbing.
Nope. I really think... There was like one piece where they said there might have been some very light, but this is
we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
And then Rudy Royston's Flatbed Buggy. And I'm going to guess out of the three things that we're going to talk about, Pat hates with a passion, Nigh Unto a White Hot Sun, two of them. And he tolerates one of them, but he might hate all three. Stay tuned, listeners. So Rudy Royston's Flatbed Buggy and Thrain Hjalmarsson, and I'm very proud that I am saying that correctly. So he's the son, Thrain, the son of Hjalmar. Thrain Hjalmarsson. What's the full name? Influence of Buildings on Musical Tone. And let's just tell the class, when you put these things into iTunes, Rudy Royston's Flatbed Buggy comes up as jazz. Thrain Hjalmarsson's album comes up as experimental. Andrew Bernstein's comes up as time-based. Now, class, guess which two Pat is really going to hate?
And actually, the full... right, it's An Exploded View of Time is the full title of Bernstein's alto solo recital.
Yes.
Let's just begin there, if it's okay with you.
Why don't you tell the class what your sweet mate at work had to say when she heard this being played over the loudspeakers at your place of employment?
And it was played at very moderate volume. So she just kind of looked at me and said, "He's just playing the same thing over and over again." And I was like, "Yes, he is." Andrew is a circular breather. It's amazing what he's doing.
Yes.
Don't know why he's doing it. I wish he'd stop doing it, but it is amazing that he's doing it. Wow. This is in the tradition of Anthony Braxton's Four Alto.
Absolutely.
I think
that's the nearest analog, absolutely.
I guess just talk to the listeners a little bit here, and then I will talk to them some.
Okay, well, so what Andrew's getting up to is and the song titles are sort of interesting. They're all over the place. But I take it, you know, if we started with the first cut, Vesica Piscis, which is what? Fish vessels? Fish something? I don't know. Fish viscera? It just sounds like he's alternating between two notes, you know, da 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 da. And then we start to get some changes. What's going on over there? Sounds like you're doing
some. I am getting in some M&Ms. We don't want me low carb during this episode. It's going to be bad enough as it is.
I see.
You just keep going, sir.
So this is something you could have on in the background, although if you tend closely to it, I think there is some interest here. But yeah, he's just alternating, for example, on this opening cut, which is about 5.5 minutes long. He starts out by alternating between two notes at, I don't know what the speed here is, but it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then somewhere around the first minute, he changes one of the notes. And that's a little interesting. And then later on, he'll change another note. So this I'm going to make an analogy here, and I'm going to say it reminded me at times of something we talked about in an earlier podcast, Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. something where, you know, there's minor changes, of, except the difference is the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble playing melodies, and Andrew is not playing melodies. He's this is almost like a tonal study. So it's ruthlessly abstract, but it's not abstract in the sense that, like, if you listened to it, you would go, what the hell is happening? It's just a couple of notes that he's alternating between, and that's kind of the process on most of the songs, except occasionally some of them are even scrunkier or squallier than that. So Pressure Wave Meditations 1 through 23, which is a 5-minute workout, is a more linear exploration of the upper reaches of overblowing on the alto. So that happens. But a lot of them are these sort of repeated riffs or patterns with minor variations. That's the general move on a lot of these songs. And I suspect, now that you tell me there's no overdubbing, I suspect there's a lot of echo here. So he's playing someplace where there's a shit ton of echo, because sometimes he gets some interesting overtones from the echo in whatever.
Yeah, kind of interactions,
yeah,
right?
And he starts working off of that, which has a certain amount of interest for me as well. So I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say that I did not hate this. I actually kind of liked it, but I didn't like it like, oh my God, I need to hear 20 hours more of this. I don't, but as a time-based experiment in sound, I found it consistently held my attention when I chose to attend to it. And then when I chose to listen to something else and have it on in the background, I could easily do that. It's probably the thing that's going to, if people have listened to For Alto, it might remind them of that. It's serialist in some ways, isn't it, right? So it's got that kind of Steve Reich. He's got that Steve Reich.
Or minimalist, I guess.
Repetitious,
right,
serialist,
yes,
mojo.
Yeah.
Happening. There are some exceptions here, but that's a lot of what's going on here. A lot of overblowing, there's some multiphonics. And if you don't like that, you're going to hate this. So basically, ask yourself the following question before you get this album. Do I have a high tolerance for Albert Eiler at his scrunkiest? If the answer is no, go to the flowchart part where it says, don't buy this album. If, however, you have a lot of patience for Albert Eiler at his scrunkiest and most multiphonic, if Pharoah Sanders seems just a little too sedate for you, if John Coltrane, at his most hyperactive, feels like he could have tried just a little harder, maybe this is the album for you.
Though all three of those players are more ecstatic, they're more intuitive, they're more expressive.
They're more emotional. This is not...
They are. This is lab coat stuff.
Yes,
it really
is. It
is
lab
right,
coat stuff.
Know?
That is absolutely right.
I think more so than For Alto,
yes.
Which is... I think the other thing to say about For Alto is that it is a... Braxton does a lot of experiments with the alto. He tries a lot of different things on, and I think he's just more expressive. There's just a wider range covered. It's truly experimental music in the sense that, you know, if you think of an experiment as something that scientifically tries to isolate the effects of one or two causes and eliminates everything else so it can focus on, you know, how is this particular phenomena changing things? And we want to eliminate other possible interactions and focus on what that phenomenon is doing, then you can start to make sense of this extremely narrowly focused, rigorous approach to trying out a couple of ideas and taking them to their utter limit and beyond. You know, my flowchart for this was, are you Andrew Bernstein's mother?
Ouch.
And, no, okay, that's a little mean. And
the, a little. Okay,
anyway.
Patrick brings out the big bastard guns. My God.
But having said that, that's not, in other words, really what I'm saying is that the results of these experiments I do not find artistically nourishing. I don't find them enjoyable, but I understand that he is not trying to please me. He is trying to explore, as he says, you know, time and very kind of narrow but deeply explored aspects of the way one could play saxophone. And it's something, you know, as somebody who is an amateur alto saxophone player, I could not do this.
Right.
So I want to make clear that this is an amazing technical feat and an amazing feat of endurance. I mean, just to physically produce these sounds is an amazing accomplishment. I don't necessarily want to be in the same room where it's taking place. And I think it's unfortunate, you know, the other really experimental album we're going to talk about in a minute, as well as Sarah Bernstein's album, are pretty well recorded recordings. They're pretty well engineered. They sound pretty good. Your feelings about the content may vary, but the recordings themselves are pretty pure and clear. This is not that flattering a recording. It's oddly kind of midfield. It's not a close mic'd thing. It's a little bit just kind of muffled sounding. I'm almost wondering if it was self-recorded or perhaps intentionally kind of DIY sounding. But a lot of avant-garde music really, if nothing else, lets you just bathe in sound. Lets you just, if not, you know, you can enjoy just the timbre and the act of notes being played by instruments and their textures if it's well recorded. And that becomes kind of more of a focus in that kind of music because, you know, the familiar melodies and harmonies and rhythms aren't necessarily there. This one is not, to me, particularly sonically pleasing. And he is not at all shy of just ending performances with kind of a very ugly, detuned squawk.
Yeah.
He is not trying to play pretty.
Nope.
That's not his intention in any way, shape, or form. If Johnny Hodges is matter, this is antimatter. They'd explode if they ever touched. It is aggressively, rigorously scientific in a way that it really does seem like, I really don't want you bothering me. I'm going to do this. And if you're not as dedicated to the search as I am, please leave the room. You know, I'm not making room for you. I'm not making any concessions for you. I'm going to do this in a sense almost more extremely than it needs to be done just to prove that I'm kind of, you know, dedicated to this exploration, this experiment. So yeah, I did not like this. I don't think it's got the same variety and rewards that something like For Alto does, which is something I take in small doses at long intervals. But it's, you know, again, I don't want to underplay the fact that this is difficult music to create as well as to listen to, and he's a very impressive technician. In itself, this doesn't have much intrinsic interest. If it leads him somewhere where these techniques are given a little more breathing room, maybe not quite so monomaniacal, it could be really interesting. You know, I mean, he certainly would have the equipment to pursue experiments that I would find more interesting if that's what he wants to do, which it may not be.
All right. Rant mode
off. That was kind of cool. But yeah, it's uncompromising.
Yep, absolutely.
And it's one that, yeah, I will talk as we go through. All this music for this episode was kind of a test in contexts and uses. Both this, to some degree, if it was quiet enough, and the influence of buildings on blah, 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 you know, you could kind of put in the background.
Yes.
This one, if I brought it too much to the foreground, just it was tough. I did headphone listening. I did pretty loud near field listening. I did, you know, some home today on the stereo.
I will admit to using this rough to annoy the neighbors.
Yeah, that'll do it. Yeah,
I will. Sure I will like, absolutely. I will cop to having turned this up from time to time just to bug people.
Yeah, well, I was cranking through the kind of list on random tonight, and as this came up, Joyce kind of gave me this pained expression.
She gave me the raised eyebrow of, why did I marry you?
Why are you doing this to me?
What am I being punished?
I just wrote this note and pushed it across to her that said, blame Mike. I'd speak, but I'm too much pain.
Okay.
So anyway, just to be aware, that's out there. And if you are interested in the kind of experimental reaches that somebody could take an alto saxophone to, definitely give it a spin.
Yeah, he's pushing things. I did like it, but, you know, like I said, I don't need a lot more of it, but I did like it.
And it is a manageable length. It's like 40-ish minutes. And then you got a lung transplant. I mean, again, amazing feat of endurance there.
What I don't want to do is to hear that album live. Can you imagine? I mean, that would be, first of all, okay, you would be impressed with him, but by the same token, you'd be like, help.
Right.
You'd see a lot of people fleeing for the exits, I think, just because it's so challenging. All right, so let's turn now to the other thing that you hate, Sveinn Hjalmarsson's influence of buildings on musical tone. So let's just start. Let me just explain why this got picked. Okay.
Okay.
You get a lot of things for review, and I mistakenly thought, well, it's jazz. It came across a review. It came to our jazz review site, so it must be jazz. This isn't jazz, kids. This is not jazz. Okay? So we should just start right there by saying we are reviewing a classical album. This is a classical album. Sveinn Hjalmarsson is really a composer. He's from Iceland, and he has like the awesomest name ever. I think I was just taken in by the name because it's a name right out of Tolkien, right? I mean, it's the name of one of the dwarves or something, right? Sveinn Hjalmarsson. It's just, he's got the coolest fucking name. But he is a composer, and this is essentially classical music of a very abstract order. So probably we shouldn't have done it, but that's my fault because I listened to it and I kind of liked it, and I just was, you know, thinking experimental, difficult. These are albums that can be described with the letter D. I don't know. Whatever. But it's not really jazz, let's be clear. It's just not. Hjalmarsson is a composer, and these pieces are performed by essentially a chamber group. And they are going to test you. They're going to test anybody. This is deeply abstract. It's very quiet. You actually have to turn it up to 11. And I'm going to guess that you just hated the shit out of this.
Yeah, I'm looking up a description of this, and it says that it was performed. So there are five tracks here. They range in time from 7 to 14 minutes in length. So substantial performances. And it says it was performed by five of Iceland's most exciting new music performers ensembles, including the Kaput Ensemble, which I love, and the Icelandic Flute Ensemble. Who knew that there was an Icelandic Flute Ensemble? Probably a few Icelanders and no one else. So yeah, there are different soundscapes. I don't know that having listened to it, I was hyper aware that each track was a different group.
Right.
Sometimes it just sounds like metal being scraped.
It does.
In an echoing acoustic.
Yes.
Sometimes there are more tones. It says this is an homage to the extreme acoustics of traditional Icelandic turf houses.
Yes.
And that's when your list of inspiration's getting kind of low. You're thinking, okay, that acid trip I took, and my love affair, and oh yes, Icelandic turf houses. That's really
stop being a bigot, you schmuck. This guy's from Iceland. it's not Madonna Leo Smith going, let's see, famous buildings. Let's next up, famous buildings, the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, you're going to be eating your words when this Icelander's next album is called Great American Golf Courses. Then you'll know.
Right. But no, I mean,
just doing it for the grand.
Comes by his inspiration, honestly. He's from there. This is his thing. Don't be a jerk about that part.
It played no role in his grant application. Absolutely none.
You can be a jerk about whether you like it or not, but don't be a jerk about his influence. I think it's legit.
I'm sure it is. No,
but Pat's right. The best way to describe this is it's very quiet. You have to turn it up. And sometimes it sounds like someone's breathing. Sometimes it sounds like someone is scraping a saw across piano wire. As abstract as it possibly can get. Minutes will go by, and unless you've got this cranked all the way up, you can't hear what's happening. There'll be like random bits of percussion. This demands absolute and total attention or complete tuned out. There's no in between here.
I know who I'm voting for, but yeah. Yeah, well, I sometimes wonder if this is a cultural thing, because a while back, I'm not going to look up the name, we did a Scandinavian saxophone player who, it was really about breath through the mouthpiece and this kind of hyper-minimalism.
Henriette Met something.
There you go. Let's listen to a couple textures. And again, nothing intrinsically invalid about that. To me, it's just kind of too little. I just want more. And again, that may just be a cultural thing that, it's not that I do like some solo performances. I do like some very delicate performances, but this is on a range where the lack of rhythm, the lack of melody, the lack of harmony, the lack of kind of rich overtones. I mean, there are certainly sounds here, but just a single violin played, there's just so much more going on in the air than is allowed to happen in most of this music that is so much about, in a very different way from Bernstein, who, of course, because he's into the circular breathing, which when I'm president of jazz will be outlawed. It's going to be one of my, no one can learn that. It's going to be the forbidden technique. He fills the sound field. This is very much about just very minimal incursions into it. And sometimes they'll make a gesture and then simply they'll repeat it for what seems like an eternity, but might literally be 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. I mean, it really is a music of patience and glacial, yes. No pun intended, right. Changes. And, again, it is, if you've never thought about these possibilities as music or performance, it's mind expanding,
yeah.
Right? It teaches you that there are people that are really this deeply focused. Again, an experiment,
yeah.
Right? We're going to isolate just a couple qualities of music and explore them very delicately and really kind of ignore everything else music can do. And there's nothing intrinsic.
It's really just about like almost the purest exploration of sound that you can have. That's what they're up to here. It's just, okay, so here's what a flute does over two notes. And let's pair that with this tiny piece of percussion, and they'll do it like 10 times in a row. And there's silence between,
right.
There's an almost priestly concern for the purity of an abstract sound. But yeah, this is my fault. I'm sorry. We get a lot of albums to review. We were doing experimental stuff. I remembered without thinking hard about it that this was experimental, and I didn't think hard enough that it's actually not jazz. This is, Hjalmarsson is really a composer. This is really classical. But, if all you know of classical music is Beethoven, Mozart, and Bach, it's good for you to find out, that there's some other shit out there. Maybe your horizons have been stretched and you're aware of Philip Glass, Groovy. This is not Philip Glass. There are people who do this kind of thing, and they get big grants and they make money doing this. They get academic jobs, and God love them for being able to make a living for doing this kind of thing. But yeah, it's more lab coat stuff in some ways. It's the lab coat end of classical almost. And you can imagine, on a classical website, people are just like, what the fuck? But this is,
right.
and they would be the howling equivalents of people who get angry at Miles for, doing rap. But, this is part of where that music has gone. And it does have an intrinsic interest, but you have to be all in. You just have to tell yourself, I'm really down for listening to some breathy, barely present flutes over rarely plinked percussion for an hour. And if you're not, then just don't go here, you know, because you'll be really unhappy.
I will say that this recording, as a recording, is a much better quality. There are moments in this performance or this recording where you can sit back and just kind of bathe in the purity of the sound. It's just that in some cases, it loses my interest. It just seems to do so little. I remember listening to this on the way to Chicago on the train and just thinking, surely there can't be any more. Oh, there's more, and not in a kind of gritting a teeth way, just kind of, I don't think this music makes any sense unless you're listening to it in the absolute best sound reproduction you can get at a fairly high level of sound. In other words, fairly loud. Otherwise, it just, you're kind of missing what is there, and what is there is pretty minimal, pretty limited. It is very kind of scientific exploration, and, it's neat for me, but I guess I like the tension between experimental gestures and more populist gestures, more thrust, more rhythm, more whatever, and that kind of collision, the tension, I really love that. This is all about experimental, abstract. There is no folk in its butt at all. And
there's no tension unless the tension is the song over, or are they going to breathe that note again?
Or right. No release. Yeah,
there's no release.
There's no, whatever you want to say, whereas I love a lot of classical music, and I'm starting to love it more and more as I get older. It's not the mainstream of that tradition. And I mean, I love Shostakovich's string quartets, which are not by any means the most avant-garde stuff, but they're challenging, but this is not that. This is a lot more.
This is way beyond that.
So anyway, the last album,
you better like this, you crap bastard.
it's a mixed bag. And so this is Rudy Royston's Flatbed Buggy. He has released a couple of solo albums. I have not heard those, albums as a leader. But he's also appeared on many people's albums as well. He's worked with J.D. Allen. He was on his wife Shami Royston's album that I like so much that we discussed a few months ago.
Dave Douglas, Bill Frisell.
Right, yes, big names. And also one musician that this reminded me of a bit was trumpeter Ron Miles, who is also Denver-based and has appeared in a lot of groups, worked with Frizzell, done his own stuff. And apparently Miles was an influence, a mentor. He played with him. So that was interesting to me. Not like it was identical to his stuff or anything, but just this is a hard-to-describe album. It's not what I expected, having heard him in various post-bop, fairly aggressive settings. It's not a typical drummer's album, is it?
No, not at all. I thought that this would be an interesting thing for you to listen to because you have long-standing hatred of the accordion, and that's one of the featured sounds here. But then you also have a long-standing love of bass clarinet, which is one of the other featured sounds here. So I thought this would be like a war for Pat's soul, and we could see who wins when he listens to this album. But anyway, I'm going to guess that you like this way more than the other two we just talked about.
That's a pretty safe guess.
It's a pretty safe guess, but it sounds like you have reservations as well. So let's hear it.
The music here is, folk is not quite the right term, but there is a kind of a laid back rural feeling to it. These performances often range up to 10 minutes long, and I'm not sure that Rudy is a structure of performances, as somebody who kind of is going to architect 10 minutes of sound for you, is where I'd love him to be. I think sometimes these kind of go, it's a very, very flat horizon music, a sense of long vistas stretching ahead of you, and sometimes towards the end of a performance, they'll get into a little bit more of a tight chord cycle and things will pick up a bit and they'll start kind of riffing. I enjoy that. I enjoy his drumming throughout. He's fantastic. The level of musicianship is very high. The accordion player is mainly a keyboard and organ player. And I've got a gift for him. It's a sledgehammer that I'm going to destroy the fucking accordion with. Lead him to the piano. I literally, my mind is like trying to say, okay, you're hurting now, but imagine what he's playing on piano. And I'm like, these are really good lines. I mean, I really like them. It's just a fucking pity he's playing it on an instrument that's blowing air through reeds and just has such limited expressive possibilities as a single line instrument. I mean, as a texture in, say, a Lloyd Cole song, one track out of a 12, I love it. As an atmospheric, we're in Paris, we're listening to, you know, fine. But as a solo instrument in a jazz context, it's mechanical. It's just a objectively worse instrument than a piano. If you ask God, what would be better to play this line? God say, you've got to be fucking kidding me. Set the accordion on fire. Give him a motherfucking piano. Dear. Surprising God curses that much. What can you say? So that was a constant thorn. And I what I've learned is the more I've listened to it, the better I like it. And this is another one that for me has to be loud.
Yep.
Especially because the music is just not, Rudy tends to write things that kind of, they're very, not minimalism, but they're just a couple small gestures and they're very kind of horizontal. There's not a lot of excitement. There's not a lot of dramatically moving chords. The melodies as such really aren't. They're more gestures. They are not wide ranging. You know, there's just kind of a couple notes that kind of murmur and a groove gets going and things kind of percolate for a long period of time. And that works better and it's a well-recorded album. It sounds great. It's on Dave Douglas's Greenleaf imprint. So that's not a problem. But it got to have it cranked up or it can just seem, you know, I was trying to listen to it in the car on the way to see my dad. And it's just, it can be really boring for stretches if you can't clearly hear everything that's going on. I do think it improved with time, but the accordion did not turn into anything
else. So the accordion lost the war for your soul.
You know, it's funny, but the bass clarinet, I love it. In this context, the bass clarinet is a great textural instrument. I love the sound. It is a little more awkward and perhaps less expressive in terms of shaping a vocal sounding line. It's good for big gestures, you know, the kind of wild, you know, gurgling. But in terms of the subtleties, it's a little harder to get those across than you can on a saxophone, a trumpet, trombone. So in this context with a very mechanical accordion, I don't think it was as effective. I think in another setting, I like it better. That said, he's an excellent player. I mean, all these musicians are top shelf. The playing throughout is great. And as I said, the accordion solos are very good. I like them as music. I don't like them on that instrument. But the lines he's playing are really good. I mean, above average. I mean, they really caught my ear.
Well, I was going to say that I liked two of the players here in particular. I didn't have the hatred that you have for the accordion. Although I didn't, it reminded me of bad westerns oftentimes when I heard it on this album, especially on the slower numbers. But I wanted to single out, I think the reed player here, who is John Ellis, he's very good. He plays a couple of saxophones here as well. And he's got some really nice lines. He's some really nice improvisation. I liked his work here. And I thought the cello player, I think it's the cello player, maybe it's the bass, whoever's doing the bowing on More of the Numbers is really good.
Yeah, Hank Roberts. I think Hank, wasn't Hank with like all those years ago in that band with Tim Byrne and Bill Frisell?
I think so. So I wanted to say it was him, but I wasn't sure every time if it was him or if it was Joe Martin on bass. But there's some really beautiful bowed string music here that I thought was really strong. And I like those moments here quite a bit as well. So those two players really stood out for me. Rudy as a drummer is very good here, of course, but it's not a showcase, right? He's not showing off. This isn't, it's not the Gene Krupa show. He's definitely serving the music, not having the music serve him. Yeah, those players in particular jumped out at me, and the bowed passages, whether cello or bass, I thought more often it was cello, were really nice, I thought. Those were good moments. And like I said, the accordion, when it reminded me of like Western TV show soundtrack moments, I wasn't happy. But it didn't do that all the time. So I didn't have as strong a reaction to it as you did.
Yeah, so way back in 87, Tim Byrne released an album called Fulton Street Mall, M-A-U-L. On Columbia. He was on Columbia for a hot minute. Then they realized, what the fuck did we do signing Tim Byrne? Oops. What were we thinking? I was so drunk. So, yeah, Hank Roberts is on that. And Bill Frisell's on it. And I'm looking for the drummer. Oh, Alex Klein. Yeah. Well, what a great group. And that's just a fantastic record from the late 80s. I just always loved that record. I saw him live in Amsterdam. I think I was the only one there who wasn't high. There's about seven of us in this huge amphitheater. So Roberts has been around, is another way of putting it. He's not new to the rodeo. Yeah, it's not what I expected. It's apparently Rudy's third album as a leader. He's not somebody that I find streaming on Spotify. The album's not dropping till the end of October, so it will not be out when we go live here. His drumming is excellent. You know, the cymbals are just kind of crashing around and beautifully captured. And I as a group, I don't know that the combination of accordion, cello, and bass clarinet, and then bass and drums it's different. But I just think it does not have a synergy for me. Though, as I said, the more you listen to it and the louder you listen to it, I think the better it gets. It's also a fairly long record.
Yeah.
And some of the pieces go on quite long. And you know, some of them, you know, like there's one like Girl Woman or something that you just kind of like, it just seems like it's a little short of material or something. It's really built on a couple of very basic gestures. And to me, it just doesn't quite have enough material to work with to be as compelling as I'd like it to be. That said, it's a grower and I have liked it better. And of course, in this context, it's certainly more accessible than Mr. Bernstein's buildings and sounds. Oh my God.
You just can't miss one more chance to shit on other people. Way to go.
I'm just saying, I mean, I think it's objectively true, just like what I said about accordions, that it is more accessible. You may like it less.
Fine.
Not to be disputed. Okay. Well, I'm going to have to like go listen to some Paul Desmond now.
Go back to the blanket for it.
Do you have any pop matters?
My tears were the
re-listened, two new things sort of came across Transom, a band, they're sort of from the Pavement school of lo-fi indie pop. I don't think they're around anymore. I think they last recorded in 2013 or something, with the unpronounceable name of Sebado, S-E-B-A-D-O-H, Sebado. And okay. They're in the Pavement lo-fi indie rock school, but they've got a little more oomph. They've got a little more kick in their bass. So I just
reacquired. I don't know why I ever got rid of it. I just reacquired their album Harmacy. It's called Harmacy because one of the players took a picture of a pharmacy that was missing the letter P, and that's the cover of the album. So the album's called Harmacy. It's a longish album for this sort of affair at 51 minutes, but it's got 19 songs. And they're all, nothing is longer than 3 minutes. Most of the songs are a minute, 2 minutes. It's sort of punky. You know, the closer is this sort of angry song called I Smell a Rat, which is a minute 30. So if you kind of like Pavement, but faster, you might like these guys. I've got a couple of their albums. I have their album, The Sebado by Sebado. I think they're founded by one of the members of Dinosaur Jr., who hooked up with some people in Massachusetts. Hence, that's where this band comes from. So if you're into sort of lo-fi, indie punk pop stuff, this might be up your alley. I kind of like it. And then I picked up another St. Vincent album. You like St. Vincent?
You know, I've tried a couple of her things. I don't know that she's ever kind of compelled me. I mean, not necessarily.
I feel the same way. I mean, I kind of like her, but there aren't songs where I go, oh, yeah, no, I'll give this a listen. I've just gotten it, so I've only listened to it a couple of times. This is her self-titled album from 2014, and I have her collaboration with David Byrne, and I have something else by her. So this is the third of her albums, and none of them have really stuck for me. So maybe this will be the one where I'll go, oh, I get it. Always trying to broaden my horizons by listening to more female rockers, just because I get a little tired of the whole cock rock thing, you know. And it's good to listen to women who are smart and intelligent, and she seems to be all of those things. But so far, this hasn't, just on a couple of listens, it hasn't really grabbed me. But we'll see. I haven't paid very close attention to it yet, so maybe when I really dig in, it'll do something for me. But I find her pleasant, and you know, I enjoy the music, but without, nothing's really landed for me. And then for some reason, I re-listened to both discs of Kenny Rogers' 42 Ultimate Hits.
Okay.
Shut up.
He had 42.
Listen, you dumbass. All right, so listen, children. This is where I school Patrick on Kenny Rogers. Kenny Rogers actually had a very fucking long career, and he started out as a rocker, you dumbass. He started out in, what is it, First Edition? He's the lead singer on Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In. That's him. That psychedelic, you don't know that psychedelic. Have you seen...
I certainly heard
Have
of
you seen, for fuck's sake, have you seen the Coen Brothers' The Big Lebowski?
I have seen that movie.
It's one of the songs on the soundtrack, and it's Kenny Rogers at like 22 singing that song. Like he does become a country music guy, but he actually started out as a rocker. And some of his first hits, even though he... later has a country music reputation, some of his first hits are actually country songs on rock albums. They're the soft cuts on some of the rock albums. So anyway, and then later he becomes like the king of MOR. He just is, he's Mr. Duet and records. I read a really funny story, and this will entertain you. One of his late albums was produced by the Gibbs, the Bee Gees. Yes, Barry.
Okay, sure.
And they had given him demos of the songs, and you know, months before the recording session. Supposedly, he showed up at the recording session, and he still had the lyric sheets in his hand. And they were kind of, one of the producers was like, "Did you not learn the fucking lyrics? Like, you've had these songs for months, dude. How do you still need the song lyrics?" And Rogers like banished that guy. He kicked the producer out of the studio. I was like, "Fuck you!" Like, threw him out, which is kind of funny. But he'd had the songs for a long time, but he still needed lyric sheets. And apparently Barry Gibb, he just wanted him to produce one song, and Barry Gibb basically said, "I produced the whole album or nothing." So he let him produce the whole album. Apparently he's pretty mellow. He was a pretty mellow dude. He's like, "Okay, do the album, I don't care." And so there's a handful of songs. Islands in the Stream is the hit, but that's a Gibb song. And when you hear it, if you think hard about it, you could totally imagine three Bee Gees singing that fucking song. So anyway, he's an interesting vocalist, kind of a nightmare reputation now on account of all the crazy plastic surgery he had late in his life, because he looks like a scary doll or something. But if you can just forget about how anodyne most of the material is, he's got an interesting voice. voice. He's got a kind of smoky, gravelly voice without even trying. Don't, you know, I'm not going to pretend that he's great. He's not. It came up. I listened to it again. I was like, oh yeah, there's a couple of decent songs here. He's better than people think, but he's not very good, let's be honest.
Okay.
But he's better than you think. He's not as bad as you think. Let's put it that way. What have you been listening to? Probably something better than Kenny Rogers.
I plan to never correct my mistaken impression. I'm just going to go to my grave slightly underestimating Kenny Rogers. That's probably what my tombstone will say. He's slightly underestimated Kenny Rogers with slightly italicized, which is very hard to do.
Did you ever listen to Jerry Harrison's solo album, Casual Gods?
Oh, yeah. I had that on vinyl. I may still have
that's
it on vinyl.
That's actually a really strong album.
Yeah, for a guy who can't sing. You know, everything, in a sense, I tend to repress everything about the ending of the Talking
right.
Heads the best I can, right? It was such a nasty divorce. And, you know, Naked, nothing really to do with the Talking Heads. It's a pretty good half that album I like a lot. The other half I can endure. True Stories was kind of a disaster, but just, and, you know, and No Talking, just Head, the group trying to go on without him. And to be honest, Burns' solo stuff has not done much for, you know, it's just a shame that the group that made a few albums I really still love a lot. And so anyway, I haven't thought about Casual Gods for decades because it reminds me of that breakup. But yeah, there's some decent songs on it. Clearly not somebody who is going to become a solo artist of any note. I don't know if he ever made another one or what.
I think he became he's produced a bunch of albums that have done really well for people. He's just more of a producer, studio guy now. Yeah,
there
which
go.
Good for him.
That
he's not
sense.
Hurting for money, I think. So.
I think he's okay. So yeah, I this review should be up by the time this podcast goes live. I listened to a review copy of Ga-da-do,
yes.
Which to me sounds like a martial arts for babies. Ga-da-do.
Outer song.
Yes, and it's they're sort of like Stereo Lab to me. The sound of the vocals, sound of the vocalist. They are several acoustic instruments, but really it's kind of dream pop, fairly produced. There are some solos on it, but that's not really what you go to the record for. I like it quite a bit. The lyrics make no sense.
No, it comes up on iTunes as jazz.
That's interesting, because that's wrong. No, it's clearly a pop album. If you look at the personnel, you might think it's jazz or jazz-related, but the instruments add to these layers of textures and arrangements, but it's a pop album. And it's, you know, it's a style that I like. I like Stereo Lab. This is not like identical to Stereo Lab, but it's, I guess for me, the closest thing to it. There's a little lounge in its soul, long kind of sprawling song structures. They're from, you guessed it, Brooklyn. Yeah. They're not from Topeka or something, but fun record. And again, as I said, I've All About Jazz should have that review if you want to hear slightly more from me on that. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 150. Though if you want just a little bit more, I briefly discuss the Chicago Jazz Fest after this bumper. Many thanks to our special guest Sarah Bernstein for coming on. You can find out more about her recordings and links to download those recordings if you'd like at sarahbernstein.com. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. You can drop us a line on Facebook, or if you want, send me a message at All About Jazz. The podcast is available at www.jazzbastard.com, at Apple Podcasts, at Stitcher, at Mixcloud, and also appears in the radio section of All About Jazz, pretty much on a bi-weekly basis. So there'll be a link there where you can play the podcast if you'd like. And you also can discover other radio programs that are more traditional playlists rather than discussion of jazz, as Mike and I love to do. Tune in next time for a special devoted to Randy Weston, who passed away earlier this year. We look at four of his albums and discuss his career. Till then, take care. The other experience, which I've gone on a lot about on Facebook, and I've got a long review of on All About Jazz, is the Chicago Jazz Fest that I went to. Not my favorite year of the festival. It didn't help that it was close to 90 and humid as hell when it wasn't pouring rain.
No Fats Waller puppet heads?
No, yeah. But I will tell you about the one outstanding thing I got to see, and there were several performances I really enjoyed very, very much. But Darcy James Argue, Secret Society was there.
Was it good?
It was very good.
Fuck.
He is an intense young man. He's got a crack band. It was neat to see because they're mainly young.
We got to get him on the show. How do we get him to come on the show?
Well, we will never do so, and I'll explain why in a second. He had a lot of women in the band, which was kind of cool. So the solo alto player was very, very good, and she also had the best shoes I've ever seen worn by a saxophone player. So that was kind of awesome. Double threat. Excellent musician. Also knows a lot more about fashion than certainly I do. And, you know, it was just really well done, but those arrangements are amazingly challenging and intricate, and he is directing kind of arm, elbows at side, very precise hand gestures, working very hard to make sure this big band executes on these really challenging arrangements, and they did a fantastic job. So I thought, you know, he mentioned there's a little shack they have. They no longer even sell CDs at the festival. There used to be a little stand, a tent they'd sell them from, but that's gone. Now it's like you can get t-shirts and hats there, but no CDs. But there's a little booth next to where they sell beer, and so you could go there. And so I went there for your birthday, Mike. I have you a copy of Infernal Machines autographed.
Oh, shit! That's awesome!
By Darcy James Argue.
And did you tell him about the program, and we wanted to get him on the show?
I didn't. Well, the thing was, I was like fifth in line, and so various people had a lot of things to say to him. I could tell he was exhausted. And then the couple before me had their picture taken with him. And I mean, Darcy James Argue is a great artist, but there is something intrinsically comic about a 50-something couple having a photograph taken with Darcy James Argue. I mean, it's funny. So I was kind of snickering a little bit, and he could tell, you're a bastard. And he's like, Darcy, you've read me like a book. So I had him do it, and I said, I've got to make up to Mike. I got on this huge box set of John Denver stuff. Please just say. And I, you know, he's just like, you are just a fuckwad. Go away, you asshole. And so he signed it. So I've got it for you, but whether he'll ever come on the show.
Well, I've seen an interview with him, and he's really articulate. Like,
absolutely.
He's a good interview.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, and the thing is, I think I feel like, and we might see that as a Gen Xer and the worst end of that spectrum, sarcastic, cynical son of a bitch, Darcy could not do what he does if he didn't have a little rainbow in his soul and just absolute kind of faith in the importance of art, and which I guess in a sense I do too, but I also have this weird, I'm both enjoying it, into it, absolutely transported by it, but there's always that little back of the head voice saying, and a lot of people would find this very silly. And it doesn't bother me. I love it, and I don't mind, but I know that from the outside this seems odd. And, you know, it's just the same deal. It's like, okay, you're having your picture taken with an obscure big band leader from Brooklyn. You know, this is awesome in a way, right? You're a fan of, and I am too, but you know, it never occurred to me to get my picture taken with him. I don't know. I'm just too cynical. So we'll see. I think it's worth trying. I'll let you do that there. You can say you're the one that wanted the autograph. I thought, again, in a way it was a weird thing. It's like, I don't want anybody's autograph, not because I don't respect him. I absolutely do. That's just an odd thing for me. I just don't want it, you know, unless I want to forge a check, which I thought, well, he's a big band leader.
I'm in the same boat with you. I care less about the autograph than having the CD. That's what I really want.
But yes.
That's
so anyway,
awesome.
That'll be coming around your birthday.
That's awesome. That is great.